The Darkest Minds by Alexandra Bracken, performed by Amy McFadden. For Stephanie and Daniel, who were in every minivan with me. Prologue. When the white noise went off, we were in the garden pulling weeds. I always reacted badly to it. It didn't matter if I was outside, eating in the mess hall, or locked in my cabin. When it came, the shrieking tones blew up like a pipe bomb between my ears. Other girls at Thurmond could pick themselves up after a few minutes, shaking off the nausea and disorientation like the loose grass clinging to their camp uniforms. But me? Hours would pass before I was able to piece myself back together. This time should have been no different. But it was. I didn't see what had happened to provoke the punishment. We were working so close to the camp's electric fence that I could smell the singed air and feel the voltage it shed vibrating in my teeth. Maybe someone got brave and decided to step out of the garden's bounds. Or maybe, dreaming big, someone fulfilled all our fantasies and threw a rock at the head of the nearest Psi Special Forces soldier. That would have been worth it. The only thing I knew for certain was that the overhead speakers spurted out two warning blares, one short, one long. The skin on my neck crawled as I leaned forward into the damp dirt, hands pressed tightly against my ears, shoulders tensed to take the hit. The sound that came over the speakers wasn't really white noise. It wasn't that weird buzz that the air sometimes takes on when you're sitting alone in silence, or the faint hum of a computer monitor. To the United States government and its Department of Psi Youth, it was the love child of a car alarm and a dental drill, turned up high enough to make your ears bleed. Literally. The sound ripped out of the speakers and shredded every nerve in my body. It forced its way past my hands, roaring over the screams of 100 teenage freaks, and settled at the center of my brain, where I couldn't reach in and rip it out. My eyes flooded with tears. I tried to ram my face into the ground. All I could taste in my mouth was blood and dirt. A girl fell forward next to me, her mouth open in a cry I couldn't hear. Everything else faded out of focus. My body shook in time with the bursts of static, curling in on itself like an old, yellowing piece of paper. Someone's hands were shaking my shoulders. I heard someone say my name, Ruby. But I was too far gone to respond. Gone, gone, gone. Sinking until there was nothing. Like the earth had swallowed me up in a single, deep breath. Then darkness. And silence. 1. Grace Summerfield was the first to die. The first in my fourth grade class, at least. I'm sure that by then thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands of kids had already up and gone the same way she had. People were slow to piece it all together, or at least they had figured out the right way to keep us in the dark long after kids started dying. When the deaths finally came to light, my elementary school put a strict ban on teachers and staff talking to us about what was then called Everhart's disease, after Michael Everhart, the first kid known to have died of it. Soon, someone somewhere decided to give it a proper name, idiopathic adolescent acute neurodegeneration, IAAN for short. And then it wasn't just Michael's disease. It was all of ours. All the adults I knew buried the knowledge beneath lying smiles and hugs. I was still stuck in my own world of sunshine ponies and my race car collection. Looking back, I couldn't believe how naive I was, just how many clues I missed. Even big things like when my dad, a cop, started working longer hours and could barely stand to look at me when he finally did come home. My mom started me on a strict vitamin regimen and refused to let me be alone even for a few minutes. On the other hand, my parents were both only children. I didn't have any dead cousins to send up red flags, and my mom's refusal to let my dad install a soul-sucking vortex of trash and mindless entertainment, that thing commonly known as a television, meant that no scary news broadcasts rocked my world. This, combined with a CIA-grade parental control set up on our internet access, pretty much ensured I'd be far more concerned with how my stuffed animals were arranged on my bed than the possibility of dying before my 10th birthday. I was also completely unprepared for what happened on the 15th of September. It had rained the night before, so my parents sent me to school wearing red galoshes. In class, we talked about dinosaurs and practiced cursive before Mrs. Port dismissed us for lunch with her usual look of relief. I remember every detail of lunch that day clearly, not because I was sitting across from Grace at the table, but because she was the first, and because it wasn't supposed to happen. She wasn't old like Grandpop's had been. She didn't have cancer like Mom's friend Sarah, no allergies, no cough, no head injury, nothing. When she died, it came completely out of the blue, and none of us understood what it meant until it was too late. Grace was locked in deep debate about whether a fly was trapped inside her Jell-O cup. The red mass shivered as she waved it around, inching out over the edge of the container when she squeezed it a bit too tight. Naturally, everyone wanted to give their opinion on whether it was a fly or a piece of candy Grace had pushed in there, including me. "I'm not a liar," Grace said. "I just..." She stopped. The plastic cup slipped from her fingers, hitting the table. Her mouth was open, eyes fixed on something just beyond my head. Grace's brow was furrowed, almost as if she was listening to someone explain something very difficult. "Grace?" I remember saying. "Are you okay?" Her eyes rolled back, flashing white in the second it took for her eyelids to droop down. Grace let out a small sigh, not even strong enough to blow away the strands of brown hair stuck to her lips. All of us sitting nearby froze, though we must have had the same exact thought. She's fainted. A week or two before, Josh Preston had passed out on the playground because, as Mrs. Port explained, he didn't have enough sugar in his system, something stupid like that. A noon aide rushed over to the table. She was one of four old ladies with white visors and whistles who rotated lunch and playground duty during the week. I have no idea if she had any medical certifications beyond a vague notion of CPR, but she pulled Grace's sagging body to the ground all the same. She had a rapt audience as she pressed her ear to Grace's hot pink t-shirt, listening for a heartbeat that wasn't there. I don't know what the old lady thought, but she started yelling, and suddenly white visors and curious faces circled in on us. It wasn't until Ben Cho nudged Grace's limp hand with his sneaker that any of us realized she was dead. The other kids started screaming. One girl, Tess, was crying so hard she couldn't breathe. Small feet stampeded toward the cafeteria door. I just sat, surrounded by abandoned lunches, staring at the cup of Jell-O and letting terror crawl through me until my arms and legs felt like they would be frozen to the table forever. If the school security officer hadn't come and carried me outside, I don't know how long I would have stayed there. "Grace is dead," I was thinking. "Grace is dead? Grace is dead." And it got worse. A month later, after the first big waves of deaths, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention released a 5-step list of symptoms to help parents identify whether their kid was at risk for IAAN. By then, half my class was dead. My mom hid the list so well that I only found it by accident when I climbed on top of the kitchen counter to look for the chocolate she kept hidden behind her baking supplies. "How to identify if your child is at risk," the flyer read. I recognized the flaming orange shade of the paper. It was the sheet Mrs. Port had sent home with her few remaining students days before. She had folded it twice and fastened it with three staples to prevent our reading it. "To the parents of Ruby only," was written on the outside and underlined three times. Three times was serious. My parents would have grounded me for opening it. Luckily for me, it was already open. 1. Your child suddenly becomes sullen and withdrawn and or loses interest in activities they previously enjoyed. 2. She or he begins to have abnormal difficulty in concentrating or suddenly becomes hyper-focused on tasks, resulting in she or he losing track of time and or neglecting him or herself or others. 3. She or he experiences hallucinations, vomiting, chronic migraines, memory loss, and/or fainting spells. 4. She or he becomes prone to violent outbursts, unusually reckless behavior, or self-injury, burns, bruising, and cuts that cannot be explained. 5. She or he develops behaviors or abilities that are inexplicable, dangerous, or cause you or others physical harm. If your child demonstrates any of the above symptoms, register him or her at IAAN.gov and wait to be contacted about the local hospital to which she or he should be taken. When I finished reading the flyer, I folded it back up neatly, put it exactly where I found it, and threw up in the sink. Grams phoned later that week, and in her usual to-the-point Grams way, explained everything to me. Kids were dying left and right, all about my age. But the doctors were working on it, and I wasn't supposed to be afraid, because I was her granddaughter, and I would be fine. I should be good and tell my parents if I felt anything weird, understand? Things turned from bad to terrifying very fast. A week after 3 of the 4 kids in my neighborhood were buried, the president made a formal address to the nation. Mom and Dad watched the live stream on the computer, and I listened from outside the office door. "My fellow Americans," President Gray began, "today we face a devastating crisis, one that threatens not only our children's lives, but the very future of our great nation. May it comfort you to know that in our time of need, we, in Washington, are developing programs, both to support the families affected by this horrid affliction and the children blessed enough to survive it." I wish I could have seen his face as he spoke, because I think he knew, he must have, that this threat, the crimp in our supposedly glorious future, had nothing to do with the kids who had died. Buried underground or burned into ash, they couldn't do anything but haunt the memories of the people who had loved them. They were gone. Forever. And that symptoms list, the one that was sent home folded and stapled by teachers, which was aired 100 times over on the news as the faces of the dead scrolled along the bottom of the screen, the government was never scared of the kids who might die, or the empty spaces they would leave behind. They were afraid of us, the ones who lived. 2. It rained the day they brought us to Thurmond, and it went on to rain straight through the week and the week after that. Freezing rain, the kind that would have been snow if it had been 5 degrees colder. I remember watching the drops trace frantic paths down the length of the school bus window. If I had been back at home, inside one of my parents' cars, I would have followed the drops' swerving routes across the cold glass with my fingertips. Now my hands were tied together behind my back, and the men in the black uniforms had packed 4 of us to a seat. There was barely room to breathe. The heat from 100-odd bodies fogged the bus windows, and it acted like a screen to the outside world. Later, the windows of the bright yellow buses they used to bring kids in would be smeared with black paint. They just hadn't thought of it yet. I was closest to the window on the 5-hour drive, so I could make out slivers of the passing landscape whenever the rain let up for a bit. It all looked exactly the same to me. Green farms, thick expanses of trees. We could have still been in Virginia for all I knew. The girl sitting next to me, the one that would later be classified blue, seemed to recognize a sign at one point because she leaned over me to get a better look. She looked a little familiar to me, like I had seen her face from around my town, or she was from the next one over. I think all of the kids with me were from Virginia, but there was no way to be sure because there was only one big rule, and that was silence. After they had picked me up from my house the day before, they'd kept me, along with the rest of the kids, in some kind of warehouse overnight. The room was washed in unnatural brightness. They sat us in a cluster on the dirty cement floor and pointed 3 floodlights toward us. We weren't allowed to sleep. My eyes were watering so badly from the dust that I couldn't see the clammy, pale faces around me, let alone the faces of the soldiers who stood just beyond the ring of lights, watching. In some weird way, they ceased to be whole men and women. In the gray haze of half-sleep, I processed them in small, terrifying pieces. The gasoline reek of shoe polish, the creak of stiff leather, the twist of disgust on their lips, the tip of a boot as it dug into my side, forcing me back awake. The next morning, the drive was completely silent except for the soldiers' radios and the kids that were crying toward the back of the bus. The kid sitting at the other end of our seat wet his pants, but he wasn't about to tell that to the red-haired PSF standing beside him. She had slapped him when he complained he hadn't eaten anything all day. I flexed my bare feet against the ground, trying to keep my legs still. Hunger was making my head feel funny, too, bubbling up every once in a while to overwhelm even the spikes of terror shooting through me. It was hard to focus, and harder to sit still. I felt like I was shrinking, trying to fade back into the seat and disappear completely. My hands were starting to lose feeling after being bound in the same position for so long. Trying to stretch the plastic band they'd tightened around them did nothing but force it to cut deeper into the soft skin there. Psy Special Forces. That's what the driver of the bus had called himself, and the others, when they collected us from the warehouse. You are to come with us on authority of the Psy Special Forces Commander Joseph Traylor. He held up a paper to prove it, so I guess it was true. I had been taught not to argue with adults anyway. The bus took a deep dip as it pulled off the narrow road and onto a smaller dirt one. The new vibrations woke whoever had been lucky or exhausted enough to fall asleep. They also sent the black uniforms into action. The men and women stood straighter and their attention snapped toward the windshield. I saw the towering fence first. The darkening gray sky cast everything in a moody, deep blue, but not the fence. It was glowing silver as the wind whistled through its open pockets. Just below my window were dozens of men and women in full uniform, escorting the bus in at a brisk jog. The PSFs in the control booth at the gate stood and saluted the driver as he navigated past them. The bus lurched to a stop, and we were all forced to stay deathly still as the camp gate slid shut behind us. The locks cracked through the silence like thunder as they came together again. We were not the first bus through. That had come a year before. We were not the last bus either. That would come in 3 more years, when the camp's occupancy maxed out. There was a single breath of stillness before a soldier in a black rain poncho rapped on the bus door. The driver reached over and pulled the lever, and ended anyone's hope that this was a short pit stop. The PSF was an enormous man, the kind you'd expect to play an evil giant in a movie or a villain in a cartoon. He kept his hood up, masking his face, hair, and anything that would have let me recognize him later. I guess it didn't matter. He wasn't speaking for himself. He was speaking for the camp. "You will stand and exit the bus in an orderly fashion," he yelled. The driver tried to hand him the microphone, but the soldier knocked it away with his hand. "You will be divided into groups of 10, and you will be brought in for testing. Do not try to run. Do not speak. Do not do anything other than what is asked of you. Failure to follow these instructions will be met with punishment." At 10, I was one of the younger kids on the bus, though there were certainly a few kids younger. Most seemed to be 12, even 13. The hate and mistrust burning in the soldier's eyes might have shrunken my spine, but it only sparked rebellion in the older kids. "Go screw yourself!" someone yelled from the back of the bus. We all turned at once, just in time to see the PSF with the flaming red hair launch the butt of her rifle into the teenage boy's mouth. He let out a shriek of pain and surprise as the soldier did it again, and I saw a faint spray of blood burst from his mouth when he took his next angry breath. With his hands behind his back, there was no way he could block the attack. He just had to take it. They began moving kids off the bus, one seat of 4 at a time. But I was still watching that kid, the way he seemed to cloud the air around him with silent, toxic fury. I don't know if he felt me staring or what, but the boy turned around and met my gaze. He nodded at me, like an encouragement, and when he smiled, it was around a mouthful of bloody teeth. I felt myself being hauled up and out of my seat, and almost before I realized what was happening, I was slipping down the wet bus steps and tumbling into the pouring rain. A different PSF lifted me off my knees and guided me in the direction of two other girls about my age. Their clothes clung to them like old skin, translucent and drooping. There were nearly 20 PSFs on the ground, swarming the neat, small lines of kids. My feet had been completely swallowed by the mud, and I was shivering in my pajamas, but no one took notice, and no one came up to cut the plastic binding our hands. We waited, silently, tongues clamped between our teeth. I looked up to the clouds, turning my face to the pounding rain. It looked like the sky was falling, piece by piece. The last groups of four were being lifted off the bus and dropped onto the ground, including the boy with a broken face. He was the last one off, just behind a tall blonde girl with a blank stare. I could barely make them out through the sheet of rain and the foggy bus windows, but I was sure I saw the boy lean forward and whisper something into the girl's ear, just as she took the first step off the bus. She nodded, a quick jerk of her chin. The second her shoes touched the mud, she bolted to the right, ducking around the nearest PSF's hands. One of the PSFs barked out a terrifying, "Stop!" But she kept running straight for the gates. With everyone's attention turned toward her, no one thought to look back at the boy still on the bus. No one but me. He came slinking down the steps, the front of his white hooded sweatshirt stained with his own blood. The same PSF who had hit him before was now helping him down to the ground, as she had done for the rest of us. I watched her fingers close around his elbow and felt the echo of her grip on my own newly bruised skin. I watched him turn and say something to her, his face a mask of perfect calm. I watched the PSF let go of his arm, take her gun out of its holster, and without a word, without even blinking, stick the barrel inside of her mouth and pull the trigger. I don't know if I screamed aloud or if the strangled sound had come from the woman waking up to what she was doing 2 seconds too late to stop it. The image of her face, her slack jaw, her eyes bulging out of her skull, the ripple of suddenly loose skin, stayed burned into the air like a photo negative far longer than the explosion of pink, misty blood and clumps of hair against the bus. The kid standing next to me dropped into a dead faint, and then there wasn't a single one of us that wasn't screaming. The PSF hit the ground the exact same moment the girl was tackled into the mud. The rain washed the soldier's blood down off the bus windows and yellow panels, stretching the bloated dark lines, drawing them out as they disappeared completely. It was that fast. The boy was looking only at us. "Run!" he yelled through his broken teeth. "What are you doing? Run! Run!" And the first thing that went through my mind wasn't, "What are you?" or even, "Why?" It was, "But I have nowhere else to go." He might as well have blown the entire bus up for the panic it caused. Some kids listened and tried to bolt for the fence, only to have their path blocked by the line of soldiers in black that seemed to pour out of the air. Most just stood there and screamed and screamed and screamed, the rain falling all around, the mud sucking their feet down firmly in place. A girl knocked me down to the ground with her shoulder as the other PSFs rushed for the boy still standing in the bus doorway. The soldiers were yelling at us to sit on the ground, to stay frozen there. I did exactly as I was told. "Orange," I heard one of them yell into his walkie-talkie, "we have a situation at the main gate. I need restraints for an orange." It wasn't until after they had rounded us back up and had the boy with a broken face on the ground that I dared to look up. And that I began to wonder, dread trickling up my spine, if he was the only one who could do something like that, or if everyone around me was there because they could cause someone to hurt themselves that way too. "Not me," the words blazed through my head. "Not me. They made a mistake. A mistake." I watched with a feeling of hollowness at the center of my chest as one of the soldiers took a can of spray paint in hand and painted an enormous orange X over the boy's back. The boy had only stopped yelling because two PSFs had pulled a strange black mask down over the lower part of his face, like they were muzzling a dog. Tension beaded on my skin like sweat. They marched our lines through the camp toward the infirmary for sorting. As we walked, we saw kids heading in the opposite direction from a row of pathetic wood cabins. All of them were wearing white uniforms, with a different colored X marked on each of their backs and a number written in black above it. I saw five different colors in all: green, blue, yellow, orange, and red. The kids with the green and blue X's were allowed to walk freely, their hands swinging at their sides. Those with a faint yellow X or an orange or red one were forced to fight through the mud with their hands and feet in metal cuffs, a long chain connecting them in a line. The ones marked with orange smears had the muzzle-like masks over their faces. We were hurried into the bright lights and dry air of what a torn paper sign had labeled infirmary. The doctors and nurses lined the long hallway, watching us with frowns and shaking heads. The checkered tile floor became slick with rain and mud, and it took all of my concentration not to slip. My nose was filled with the smell of rubbing alcohol and fake lemon. We filed, one by one, up a dark cement staircase at the back of the first floor, which was filled with empty beds and limp white curtains. Not an orange. Not a red. I could feel my guts churning deep in the pit of my stomach. I couldn't stop seeing that woman's face right when she pulled the trigger, or the mass of her bloody hair that had landed near my feet. I couldn't stop seeing my mom's face when she had locked me out in the garage. I couldn't stop seeing Graham's face. "She'll come," I thought. "She'll come. She'll fix Mom and Dad, and she will come to get me. She'll come. She'll come. She'll come." Upstairs, they finally cut the plastic binding that tied our hands and divided us again, sending half down to the right end of the freezing hallway and half to the left. Both sides looked exactly the same, no more than a few closed doors and a small window at the very end. For a moment, I did nothing but watch the rain pelt that tiny, foggy pane of glass. Then the door on the left swung open with a low whine, and the face of a plump, middle-aged man appeared. He cast one look in our direction before whispering something to the PSF at the head of the group. One by one, more doors opened and more adults appeared. The only thing they had in common, aside from their white coats, was a shared look of suspicion. Without a single word of explanation, the PSFs began pulling and pushing kids toward each white coat and its associated office. The outburst of confused, distressed noises that erupted from the lines was hushed with a piercing buzzer. I fell back onto my heels, watching the door shut one by one, wondering if I would ever see those kids again. What's wrong with us? My head felt like it was full of wet sand as I looked over my shoulder. The boy with a broken face was nowhere, but his memory had chased me all the way through the camp. Did they bring us here because they thought we had Everhart's disease? Did they think we were going to die? How had that boy made the PSF do what she had done? What had he said to her? I felt a hand slide into mine as I stood there, trembling hard enough for my joints to hurt. The girl, the same one that had pulled me down into the mud outside, gave me a fierce look. Her dark blonde hair was plastered against her skull, framing a pink scar that curved between her top lip and nose. Her dark eyes flashed, and when she spoke, I saw that they had cut the wires on her braces, but had left the metal nubs glued to her front teeth. "Don't be scared," she whispered. "Don't let them see." The handwritten label on the tag of her jacket said, "Samantha Dahl." It stuck up against the back of her neck like an afterthought. We stood shoulder to shoulder, close enough that our linked fingers were hidden between the fabric of my pajama pants and her purple puffer jacket. They had picked her up on the way to school the same morning they had come for me. That had been a day ago, but I remembered seeing her dark eyes burning bright with hate at the back of the van they had locked us in. She hadn't screamed as the others had. The kids who had disappeared through the doors now came back through them, clutching gray sweaters and shorts in their hands. Instead of falling back into our line, they were marched downstairs before anyone could think to get a word or questioning look in. They don't look hurt. I could smell permanent marker and something that might have been rubbing alcohol, but no one was bleeding or crying. When it was finally the girls' turn, the PSF at the head of the line forced us apart with a sharp jerk. I wanted to go in with her, to face whatever was behind the door. Anything had to be better than being alone again without anyone or anything to anchor myself to. My hands were shaking so badly that I had to cross my arms and grip my elbows to get them to stop. I stood at the front of the line, looking at the gleaming span of checkered tile between the PSF's black boots and my mud-splattered toes. I was already tired down to my bones from the sleepless night before, and the scent of the soldier's boot polish sent my head deeper into a fog. And then they called for me. I found myself in a dimly lit office, half the size of my cramped bedroom at home, with no memory of ever having walked into it. Name? I was looking at a cot and a strange halo-shaped gray machine hanging over it. The white coat's face appeared from behind the laptop on the table. He was a frail-looking man, whose thin silver glasses seemed to be in serious danger of sliding off his nose with every quick movement. His voice was unnaturally high, and he didn't so much as say the word as squeak it. I pressed my back against the closed door, trying to put space between me, the man, and the machine. The white coat followed my gaze to the cot. That's a scanner. There's nothing to be afraid of. I must not have looked convinced because he continued. Have you ever broken a bone or bumped your head? Do you know what a CT scan is? It was the patience in his voice that drew me forward a step. I shook my head. In a minute, I'm going to have you lie down, and I'll use that machine to check to make sure your head is all right. But first, you need to tell me your name. Make sure your head is all right. How did he know? Your name, he said, the words taking on a sudden edge. Ruby, I answered, and had to spell my last name for him. He began typing on the laptop, distracted for a moment. My eyes drifted back over to the machine, wondering how painful it would be for me to have the inside of my head inspected, wondering if he could somehow see what I had done. Damn, they're getting lazy, the white coat groused, more to himself than to me. Didn't they pre-classify you? I had no idea what he was talking about. When they picked you up, did they ask you questions? He asked, standing. The room wasn't large by any means. He was by my side in two steps, and I was in full panic and two heartbeats. Did your parents report your symptoms to the soldiers? Symptoms? I squeezed out. I don't have any symptoms. I don't have the... He shook his head, looking more annoyed than anything else. Calm down. You're safe here. I'm not going to hurt you. The white coat kept talking, his voice flat, something flickering in his eyes. The lines sounded practiced. There are many different kinds of symptoms, he explained, leaning down to look at me eye to eye. All I could see were his crooked front teeth and the dark circles rimming his eyes. His breath smelled like coffee and spearmint. Many different kinds of children. I'm going to take a picture of your brain, and it'll help us put you with the others who are like you. I shook my head. I don't have any symptoms. Grams is coming. She is. I swear she'll tell you, please. Tell me, sweetheart, are you very good at math and puzzles? Greens are incredibly smart and have astonishing memories. My mind jumped back to the kids outside, to the colored X's on the back of their shirts. Green, I thought. What had the other colors been? Red, blue, yellow, and orange, like the boy with the bloody mouth. All right, he said, taking a deep breath. Just lie back on that cot and we'll get started. Now, please. I didn't move. Thoughts were rushing too quickly to my head. It was a struggle to even look at him. Now? He repeated, moving toward the machine. Don't make me call in one of the soldiers. They won't be nearly as nice, believe me. A screen on the side panel came alive with a single touch, and then the machine itself lit up. At the center of a gray circle was a bright white light, blinking as it set itself up for another test. It was breathing out hot air in sputters and whines that seemed to prick every pore on my body. All I could think was, he'll know. He'll know what I did to them. My back was flat against the door again, my hand blindly searching for the handle. Every single lecture my dad had ever given me about strangers seemed to be coming true. This was not a safe place. This man was not nice. I was shaking so hard he might have thought I was going to faint. That, or he was going to force me onto the cot himself and hold me there until the machine came down and locked over me. I hadn't been ready to run before, but I was now. As my fingers tightened on the door handle, I felt his hand push through my unruly mass of dark hair and seize the back of my neck. The shock of his freezing hand on my flushed skin made me flinch, but it was the explosion of pain at the base of my skull that made me cry out. He stared at me, unblinking, his eyes suddenly unfocused, but I was seeing everything, impossible things. Hands drumming on a car's steering wheel, a woman in a black dress leaning forward to kiss me, a baseball flying toward my face out on a diamond, an endless stretch of green field, a hand running through a little girl's hair. The images played out behind my closed eyes like an old home movie. The shapes of people and objects burned themselves into my retinas and stayed there, floating around behind my eyelids like hungry ghosts. "Not mine!" my mind screamed. "These don't belong to me!" But how could they have been his? Each image? Were they memories? Thoughts? Then I saw more. A boy, the same scanner machine above him flickering and smoking. Yellow. I felt my lips form the words as if I had been there to say them. I saw a small red-haired girl from across a room, much like this one, saw her lift a finger, and the table and laptop in front of her rise several inches from the ground. Blue. Again, the man's voice in my head. A boy holding a pencil between his hands, studying it with a terrifying intensity. The pencil bursting into flames. Red. Cards with pictures and numbers on them held up in front of a child's face. Green. I squeezed my eyes shut, but I couldn't pull back from the images that came next. The lines of marching, muzzled monsters. I was standing high above, looking down through the rain-spattered glass, but I saw the handcuffs and the chains. I saw everything. I'm not one of them. Please. 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 I fell, dropping to my knees, bracing my hands against the tile, trying to keep from being sick all over myself and the floor. The white coat's hand still gripped the back of my neck. I'm green, I sobbed, the words half lost to the machine's buzzing. The light had been bright before, but now it only amplified the pounding behind my eyes. I stared into his blank eyes, willing him to believe me. I'm green. Please. Please. But I saw my mother's face, the smile the boy with the broken mouth had given me, like he had recognized something of himself in me. I knew what I was. Green. I looked up at the sound of the voice that floated down to me. I stared, and he stared right back, his eyes unfocused. He was mumbling something now, his mouth full of mush, like he was chewing on the words. I'm green, he said, shaking his head. His voice sounded stronger. I was still on the floor when he went to shut down the machine, and so shocked when he sat back down at the desk that I actually forgot to cry. But it wasn't until he picked up the green spray paint and drew that enormous X over the back of the uniform shirt and handed it to me that I remembered to start breathing. "It'll be okay," I told myself as I walked back down the cold hallway, down the steps, to the girls and men in uniforms waiting for me below. It wasn't until that night, as I lay awake in my bunk, that I realized I would only ever have one chance to run, and I hadn't taken it. 3. Samantha, Sam, and I were both assigned to Cabin 27, along with the rest of the girls from our bus that were classified as green. 14 in all, though by the next day there were 20 more. They capped the number at 30 a week later, and moved on to filling the next wooden structure along the camp's perpetually soggy and trampled main trail. Bunks were assigned based on alphabetical order, which put Sam directly above me. A small mercy, seeing as the rest of the girls were nothing like her. They spent the first night either stunned into silence or sobbing. I didn't have time for tears anymore. I had questions. "What are they going to do with us?" I whispered up to her. We were at the far left end of the cabin, our bunk wedged in the corner. The walls of the structure had been thrown together so quickly that they weren't completely sealed. Every now and then a freezing draft and sometimes a snowflake whistled in from the silent outdoors. "I don't know," she said quietly. A few beds over, one of the girls had finally dropped off into the oblivion of sleep, and her snores were helping to cover our conversation. When a PSF had escorted us to our new residence, it had been with several warnings. No talking after lights out, no leaving, no use of freak abilities, intentional or accidental. It was the first time I had ever heard anyone refer to what we could do as freak abilities, instead of the polite alternative, symptoms. "I guess keep us here until they figure out a cure," Sam continued. "That's what my dad said, at least, when the soldiers came to get me. What did your parents say?" My hands hadn't stopped shaking from earlier, and every time I tried shutting my eyes, all I could see were the white coats, blank ones, staring right back into mine. The mention of my parents only made the pounding in my head that much worse. I don't know why I lied. It was easier, I guess, than the truth. Or maybe because some small part of it felt like it was the actual truth. "My parents are dead." She sucked in a sharp breath between her teeth. "I wish mine were, too."
"You don't mean that!"
"They're the ones that sent me here, aren't they?" It was dangerous how fast her voice was rising.
"Obviously, they wanted to get rid of me!"
I don't think..." I began, only to stop myself. Hadn't my parents wanted to get rid of me, too?
"Whatever, it's fine," she said, though it clearly wasn't, and it wasn't ever going to be. "We'll stay here and stick together, and when we get out, we can go wherever we want, and no one will stop us."
My mom used to say that sometimes just saying something aloud was enough to make it true. I wasn't so sure about that, but the way Sam said it, the low burn beneath her words, made me reconsider. It suddenly seemed possible that it could work out that way, that if I couldn't go home, I would still be all right in the end if I could just stick with her. It was like, wherever Sam went, a path opened up behind her. All I had to do was stay in her shadow, out of the PSF's line of sight, and avoid doing anything that would call attention to me. It worked that way for 5 years. 5 years feels like a lifetime when one day bleeds into the next, and your world doesn't stretch any farther than the gray electric fence surrounding 2 miles of shoddy buildings and mud. I was never happy at Thurmond, but it was bearable because Sam was there to make it that way. She was there with the eye roll when Vanessa, one of our cabin mates, tried to cut her own hair with garden shears to look more stylish. "For who?" Sam had muttered, her reflection in the washroom mirror. The silly cross-eyed face behind the back of the PSF lecturing her for speaking out of turn yet again, and the firm, but gentle, reality check when the girl's imaginations started running too wild, or rumors sprung up about the PSFs letting us go. Sam and I, we were realists.
We knew we weren't getting out. Dreaming led to disappointment, and disappointment to a kind of depressed funk that wasn't easy to shake. Better to stay in the gray than get eaten by the dark. 2 years into life at Thurmond, the camp controllers started work on the factory. They had failed at rehabilitating the dangerous ones and hauled them off in the night, but the so-called improvements didn't stop there. It dawned on them that the camp needed to be entirely self-sufficient. From that point on, we'd be growing and cooking our own food to eat, mucking out the washrooms, making our uniforms, and even making theirs. The brick structure was all the way at the far west side of the camp, cupped in one end of Thurmond's long rectangle. They had us dig out the foundation for the factory, but the camp controllers didn't trust us with the actual building of it. We watched it go up, floor by floor, wondering what it was for, and what they would do to us there. That was back when all sorts of rumors were floating around like dandelion fluff in the wind. Some thought the scientists were coming back for more experiments. Some thought the new building was where they were going to move the reds, oranges, and yellows, if and when they returned. And some thought it was where they were going to get rid of us, once and for all. "We'll be fine," Sam had told me one night, just before they turned the lights out. "No matter what. You hear me?" But it wasn't fine. It wasn't fine then, and it wasn't fine now. There was no talking in the factory, but there were ways around it. Actually, the only time we were allowed to speak to one another was in our cabin before lights out. Everywhere else, it was all work, obedience, silence. But you can't go on for years together without developing a different kind of language, one that was all sly grins and quick glances. Today, they had us polishing and relacing the PSF's boots and tightening their uniform buttons, but a single wiggle of a loose black shoelace and a look toward the girl standing across from you, the same one who had called you an awful word the night before, spoke volumes. The factory wasn't much of a factory. A better name probably would have been the warehouse, only because the building consisted of just one huge room with a pathway suspended over the work floor. The builders had enough thought to install four large windows on the west and east walls, but because there was no heat in the winter or AC in the summer, they tended to let more bad weather in than sunlight. The camp controllers tried to keep things as simple as possible. They set up rows and rows of tables lengthwise across the dusty concrete floor. There were hundreds of us working in the factory that morning, all in green uniforms. 10 PSFs patrolled the walkways above us, each with his or her own black rifle. Another 10 were on the ground with us. It was no more unnerving than usual to feel the press of their eyes coming from every direction, but I hadn't slept well the night before, even after a full day of work in the garden. I had gone to bed with a headache and woken up with a glossy fever fog over my brain and a sore throat to match. Even my hands seemed lethargic, my fingers stiff as pencils. I knew I wasn't keeping up, but it was like drowning in a way. The harder I tried to work, to keep my head above water, the more tired I felt and the slower I became. After a while, even standing upright was taking too much effort, and I had to brace myself against the table to keep from swan diving straight into it. On most days, I could get away with a snail's pace. It wasn't like they had us doing important work, or that we had deadlines to meet. Every task we were assigned was just glorified busy work to keep our hands moving, our bodies occupied, and our minds dead with boredom. Sam called it forced recess. They let us out of our cabins, and the work wasn't difficult or tiring like it was in the garden, but no one wanted to be there, especially when bullies came to the playground. I knew he was standing behind me long before I heard him start counting the finished, shiny shoes in front of me. He smelled like spiced meat and car oil, which already was an unsettling combination before a whiff of cigarette smoke was added to the mix. I tried to straighten my back under the weight of his gaze, but it felt like he had taken two fists and dug the knuckles deep between my shoulder blades. 15, 16, 17. How was it that they could make mere numbers sound sharp? At Thurmond, we weren't allowed to touch one another, and we were beyond forbidden to touch one of the PSFs. but it didn't mean that they couldn't touch us. The man took two steps forward. His boots, exactly like the ones on the table, nudged the back of my standard white slip-ons. When I didn't respond, he snuck an arm past my shoulder on the pretense of sorting through my work and pressed me into his chest. "Shrink," I told myself, curling my spine down, bending my face to the task in front of me. "Shrink and disappear." "Worthless," I heard the PSF grunt behind me. His body was letting off enough heat to warm the entire building. "You're doing this all wrong. Look. Watch, girl." I got my first real glance at him out of the corner of my eye as he ripped the polish-stained cloth out of my hand and moved to my side. He was short, only an inch or two taller than me, with a stubby nose and cheeks that seemed to flap every time he took a breath. "Like this," he was saying, swiping at the boot he had taken. "Look at me." A trick. We weren't supposed to look them directly in the eyes, either. I heard a few chuckles around me, not from the girls, but from more PSFs gathered at his back. It felt like I was boiling from the inside out. It was December, and the factory couldn't have been warmer than 40 degrees, but lines of sweat were racing down the curves of my cheeks, and I felt a hard, stiff cough welling up in my throat. There was a light touch at my side. Sam couldn't look up from her own work, but I saw her eyes slide over to me, trying to assess the situation. A wave of furious red was making its way up from her throat to her face, and I could only imagine the kinds of words she was holding back. Her bony elbow brushed against mine again, as if to remind me that she was still there. Then, with agonizing slowness, I felt the same PSF move behind me again, brushing my shoulder and arm with his own as he gently deposited the boot back on the table in front of me. "These boots," he said in a low, purring voice as he tapped the plastic bin containing all of my finished work. "Did you lace them?" If I hadn't known what kind of punishment I'd get for it, I would have burst out into tears. I felt more stupid and ashamed the longer I stood there, but I couldn't say anything. I couldn't move. My tongue had swelled up to twice its usual size behind my clenched teeth. The thoughts buzzing around my head were light and edged with a strange, milky quality. My eyes could barely focus now. More snickers from behind us. "The laces are all wrong." His other arm wrapped around my left side until there wasn't an inch of his body that wasn't pressed up against mine. Something new rose in my throat, and it tasted strongly of acid. The tables around us had gone completely quiet and still. My silence only egged him on. With no warning, he picked up the bin of boots and flipped it over, so dozens of boots scattered across the length of the table with a terrible amount of noise. Now everyone in the factory was looking. Everyone saw me, thrust out into the light. "Wrong, wrong, 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 wrong," he sang out, knocking the boots around. But they weren't. They were perfect. They were just boots. But I knew whose feet would slide into them. I knew better than to screw it up. "Are you as deaf as you are dumb, Green?" And then, clear as day, low as thunder, I heard Sam say, "That was my bin." And all I could think of was, "No, oh no." I felt the PSF shift behind me, pull back in surprise. They always acted this way, surprised that we remembered how to use words and use them against them. "What did you say?" he barked. I could see the insult rising to her lips. She was rolling it around on her tongue like a piece of hard lemon candy. "You heard me. Or did inhaling that polish kill whatever helpless brain cells you had left?" I knew what she wanted when she looked over at me. I knew what she was waiting for. It was exactly what she had just given me. Backup. I hung back a step, crossing my arms over my stomach. "Don't do it," I told myself. "Don't. She can handle it." Sam had nothing to hide, and she was brave, but every time she did this, every time she stood up for me and I shrunk back in fear, I felt like I was betraying her. Once again, my voice was locked away behind layers of caution and fear. If they were to look into my file, if they were to see the blanks there and start looking into filling them, no punishment they'd give Sam would ever compare to the one they'd give me. That was what I told myself, at least. The right side of the guy's lips inched up, turning a grim line into a mocking smirk. "We've got a live one." Come on. Come on, Ruby. It was all in the tilt of her head and the tightness of her shoulders. She didn't understand what would happen to me. I wasn't brave like she was. But I wanted to be. I so, so wanted to be. I can't. I didn't have to say the words aloud. She read it easily enough on my face. I saw the realization come together behind her eyes even before the PSF stepped forward and took her arm, yanking her away from the table and from me. "Turn around," I begged. Her blonde ponytail was swinging with each step, rising above the shoulders of the PSFs escorting her out. "Turn around." I needed her to see how sorry I was, to understand the clenching in my chest and the nausea in my stomach had nothing to do with the fever. Every single desperate thought that ran through my head made me feel sick with disgust. The eyes that had been on me lifted two by two, and the soldier never came back to finish his personal brand of torment. There was no one left to see me cry. I had learned to do it silently, without any fuss, years ago. They had no reason to so much as look my way again. I was back in the long shadow Sam had left behind. The punishment for speaking out of turn was a day's worth of isolation, handcuffed to one of the gateposts in the garden, regardless of the temperature or the weather. I'd seen kids sitting in a mound of snow, blue in the face, and without a single blanket to cover them. Even more sunburned, covered in mud, or trying to scratch patches of bug bites with their free hands. Unsurprisingly, the punishment for talking back to a PSF or camp controller was the same, only you also weren't given food and sometimes not even water. The punishment for a repeat offense was something so terrible Sam wouldn't or couldn't talk about it when she finally returned to our cabin 2 days later. She came in, wet and shaking from the winter rain, looking like she had slept no more than I had. I slid off my bunk and was on my feet, rushing to her side before she had even made it halfway across the cabin. My hand slipped around her arm, but she pulled away, her jaw clenched in a way that made her look almost ferocious. Her cheeks and nose had been wind-whipped to a bright red, but she didn't have any bruises or cuts. Her eyes weren't even swollen from crying like mine were. There was a subtle limp to her walk, maybe, but if I hadn't known what had happened, I would have just assumed she was coming in from a long afternoon of working in the garden. "Sam?" I said, hating the way my voice shook. She didn't stop or deign to look at me until we were by our bunks, and she had one fist curled in her bedsheets, ready to pull herself up to the top bed. "Say something, please," I begged. "You stood there." Sam's voice was low and rough, like she hadn't used it for days. "You shouldn't have..." Her chin came down to rest against her chest. Long, tangled masses of hair fell over her shoulders and cheeks, hiding her expression. I felt it then, the way that the hold I had on her had suddenly sprung free. I had the strangest sensation of floating, of drifting farther and farther away with nothing and no one to cling to. I was standing right beside her, but the distance between us had split into the kind of canyon I couldn't jump across. "You're right," Sam said finally. "I shouldn't have." She drew in a shuddering breath. "But then, what would have happened to you? You would have just stood there and let him do that, and you wouldn't have defended yourself at all." And then she was looking at me, and all I wanted was for her to turn away again. Her eyes flashed darker than I had ever seen before. "They can say horrible things, hurt you, but you never fight back. And I know, Ruby, I know that's just how you are, but sometimes I wonder if you even care. Why can't you stand up for yourself just once? Her voice was barely above a whisper, but the ragged quality to it made me think she was either going to scream or burst out into hysterical tears. I glanced down to where her hands were tugging at the edges of her shorts, moving so fast and frantic that I almost didn't see the angry red marks that circled her wrists. Sam, Samantha, I want... She swallowed hard, her tears caught in her eyelashes but didn't fall. I want to be alone now. Just for a while. I shouldn't have reached for her. Not with fever and exhaustion pressing down on me. Not while I was trembling with a bone-deep hate for myself. But I thought, then, that if I could tell her the truth, if I could explain, she wouldn't look at me that way again. She would know that the last thing, the absolute last thing I ever wanted was for her to be hurt because of me. She was the only thing I had here. But the second my fingers touched her shoulder, the world dropped out from under me. I felt a fire start at the ends of my hair and burn its way through my skull. The fever I thought I had kicked suddenly painted the world a fuzzy shade of gray. I was seeing Sam's blank face, and she was gone, replaced by white-hot memories that didn't belong to me. A whiteboard at school filled with math problems, a golden retriever digging in a garden, a world rising and falling from the perspective of a swing, the roots of the vegetables in the garden being pulled free, the brick wall at the back of the mess hall against my face as another fist swung down toward me, a quick assault from every side, like a series of camera flashes. And when I finally came back to myself, we were still staring at each other. For a second, I thought I saw my horrified face reflect in her dark, glassy eyes. Sam wasn't looking at me. She didn't seem to be looking at anything beyond the dust floating lazy and free through the air to my right. I knew that blank look. I'd seen my mother wear it years before. "Are you new here?" she demanded, suddenly defensive and startled. Her eyes flicked down from my face to my bony knees, then back up again. She sucked in a deep breath, as if coming up for air after a long time beneath dark waters. "Do you have a name, at least?" "Ruby," I whispered. It was the last word I spoke for nearly a year. 4. I woke to cold water and a woman's soft voice. "You're all right," she was saying. "You'll be fine." I'm not sure who she thought she was fooling with her sweet little BS, but it wasn't me. I let her bring the wet towel up to my face again, savoring her warmth as she leaned in closer. She smelled of rosemary and past things. For a second, just one, her hand came to rest against mine, and it was almost more than I could take. I wasn't at home, and this woman wasn't my mother. I started gasping, desperate to keep everything inside me. I couldn't cry, not in front of her, or any of the other adults. I wouldn't give them the pleasure. "Are you still in pain?" The only reason I opened my eyes was because she pulled them open herself, one at a time, shining an intense light in each. I tried to throw my hands up to shield them, but they had strapped me down in Velcro cuffs. Fighting against the restraints was pointless. The woman clucked her tongue and stepped back, taking her flowery fragrance with her. The smell of antiseptic and peroxide flooded the air, and I knew exactly where I was. The sounds of Thurman's infirmary faded in and out in uneven waves. Some kid crying out in pain, boots clipping against the white tile floors, the creak of wheelchair wheels. I felt like I was standing above a tunnel with my ear to the ground, listening to the hum of cars passing beneath me. "Ruby?" The woman was wearing blue scrubs and a white coat. With her pale skin and white blonde hair, she all but disappeared into the thin curtain that had been pulled around my bed. She caught me staring and smiled, so wide and so pretty. The woman was the youngest doctor I'd ever seen in Thurmond, though admittedly I could count my trips to the infirmary on one hand. I went once for the stomach flu and dehydration after what Sam called my gut-puking spectacular, and once for a sprained wrist. Both times, I felt far worse after being groped by a pair of wrinkled hands than I had before I'd come in. Nothing cures a cold faster than the thought of an old perv wearing a cologne of alcohol and lemon hand soap. This woman, she was unreal. Everything about her. "My name is Dr. Begbie. I'm a volunteer with the Leda Corporation." I nodded, glancing at the gold swan insignia on her coat pocket. She leaned in closer. "We're a big medical company that does research and sends doctors in to help care for you guys at the camps. If it makes you feel more comfortable, you're more than welcome to call me Kate and leave off the doctor business." Sure I was. I stared at the hand she extended toward me. Silence hung between us, punctuated by the pounding in my head. After an awkward moment, Dr. Begbie stuffed her hand back into the pocket of her lab coat, but not before letting it stray over the restraint securing my left hand to the bed's guardrail. "Do you know why you're here, Ruby? Do you remember what happened?" Before or after the tower tried to fry my brain? But I couldn't say it out loud. When it came to the adults, it was better not to talk. They had a way of hearing one thing and processing it as something else. No reason to give them an excuse to hurt you. It had been 8 months since I'd last used my voice. I wasn't sure I even remembered how. The doctor somehow guessed the question I was barely holding back at the tip of my tongue. "They turned on the calm control after a fight broke out in the mess hall. It seems that things got a bit out of hand." That was an understatement. The white noise, calm control, the higher powers called it, was used to settle us down, so to speak, while it did absolutely nothing to them. It was like a dog whistle, the pitch tuned perfectly so only our freak brains could pick it up and process it. They turned it on for a whole host of reasons, sometimes for things as small as a kid accidentally using their ability, or to stamp out unruliness in one of the cabins. But in both of those instances, they would have piped the noise directly into whatever building the kids were in. If they used it across the camp, blasting it over the speakers for us all to hear, then things must have gotten really out of hand. They must have been worried that there was a spark that would have set the rest of us ablaze. There was no hint of hesitation on Dr. Begbie's face as she unstrapped my wrists and ankles. The towel she had been using to clean my face hung limp on the guardrail, dripping water. Bright red splotches soaked through its white fabric. I reached up and touched my mouth, my cheeks, my nose. When I pulled my fingers away, I was only half surprised to see that they were coated with dark blood. It was crusted between my nostrils and lips, as if someone had clocked me right in the honker. Trying to sit up was the worst idea that crossed my mind. My chest screamed in pain, and I was flat on my back again before I even registered falling. Dr. Begbie was beside me in an instant, cranking the metal bed into an upright position. "You have some bruised ribs," she said. I tried to take a deep breath, but my chest was too tight to inhale anything more than a choked gasp. She must not have noticed, because she was looking at me with those kind eyes again, saying, "May I ask a few questions?" The fact that she asked my permission was amazing in and of itself. I studied her, searching for the hatred buried beneath the layer of pleasantness on her face, the fear hovering in her soft eyes, the disgust caught in the corner of her smile. Nothing. Not even annoyance. Some poor kid started to throw up in the stall to my right. I could see his dark outline like a shadow against the curtain. There was no one sitting with him, no one holding his hand, just him and his bowl of puke. And here I was, my heart skipping beats out of fear that the fairy tale princess sitting next to me was going to have to put me down like a rabid dog. She didn't know what I was. She couldn't have known. "You're being paranoid," I told myself. "Get a grip." Dr. Begbie pulled a pen out of her messy bun. "Ruby, when they turned on the calm control, do you remember falling forward and hitting your face?"
"No," I said. "I was already on the ground."
I didn't know how much to tell her. The smile on her face stretched, and there was something smug about it. "Do you usually experience this much pain and bleeding from the calm control?" Suddenly, the pain in my chest had nothing to do with my ribs. "I'll take that as a no." I couldn't see what she was writing, only that her hand and pen were flying across the paper, scribbling as though her life depended on it. I always took the white noise harder than the other girls in my cabin. But blood? Never. Dr. Begbie was humming lightly under her breath as she wrote, some song that I thought might have been by the Rolling Stones. "She's with the camp controllers," I reminded myself. "She is one of them." But in another world, she might not have been. Even though she was wearing the scrubs and white coat, Dr. Begbie didn't look much older than I was. She had a young face, and it was probably a curse to her in the outside world. I had always thought that people born before Generation Freak were the lucky ones. They lived without fear of what would happen when they stepped over the border between childhood and adolescence. As far as I knew, if you were older than 13 when they started rounding kids up, you were home free. You got to pass Freak Camp on the board game of life and head straight on to Normalville. But looking at Dr. Begbie now, seeing the deep lines carved in her face that no one in their 20s should have had, I wasn't so sure they had gotten off scot-free. They'd gotten a better deal than what we ended up with, though. Abilities. Powers that defied explanation. Mental talents so freakish, doctors and scientists reclassified our entire generation as Psi. We were no longer human. Our brains broke that mold. "I see from your chart that you were classified as abnormal intelligence in sorting," Dr. Begbie said after a while. "The scientist that sorted you, did he run you through all of the tests?" Something very cold coiled in my stomach. I might not have understood a great many things about the world. I might have only had a fourth grader's education. But I could tell when someone was trying to fish around for information. The PSFs had switched over to outright scare tactics years ago, but there was a time when all of their questioning had been done in soft voices. Fake sympathy reeked like bad breath. Does she know? Maybe she ran a few tests while I was unconscious and scanned my brain or tested my blood or something. My fingers curled one by one until both hands were tight fists. I tried to work the line of thought through, but I kept getting caught on the possibility. Fear made things hazy and light. Her question hung in the air, suspended somewhere between truth and lie. The clip of boots against the pristine tile forced my eyes up, away from the doctor's face. Each step was a warning, and I knew they were coming before Dr. Begbie turned her head. She moved to push herself away from the bed, but I didn't let her. I don't know what possessed me, but I grabbed her wrist. The list of punishments for touching an authority figure running through my head like a skipping CD, each scratch sharper than the next. We weren't supposed to touch anyone, not even each other. "It was different this time," I whispered, the words aching in my throat. My voice sounded different to my ears, weak. Dr. Begbie only had enough time to nod. The slightest movement, almost imperceptible, before a hand ripped back the curtain. I had seen this Psi Special Forces officer before. Sam called him the Grinch, because he looked like he had stepped straight out of the movie, save for no green skin. The Grinch cast one look at me, his top lip peeling back in annoyance, before waving the doctor forward. She blew out a sigh and set her clipboard down on my lap. "Thank you, Ruby," she said. "If your pain gets any worse, call for help, okay?" Was she on drugs? Who was going to help? The kid throwing up his stomach lining next door? I nodded anyway, watching her turn to go. The last glimpse I had of her was her hand dragging the curtain back around. It was nice of her to give me privacy, but a little naive given the black cameras hanging down between the beds. The bulbs were installed all over Thurmond. Lidless eyes, always watching, never blinking. There were two cameras in our cabin alone, one on each end of the room, as well as one outside the door. It seemed like overkill, but when I was first brought to camp, there were so few of us that they really could watch us all day, every day, until their brains were ready to burst from boredom. You had to squint to see it, but a tiny red light inside the black eye was the only clue that the camera had zeroed in on you. Over the years, as more and more kids were brought into Thurmond on the old school buses, Sam and I began to notice that the cameras in our cabin no longer had the blinking red lights. Not every day. Same went for the cameras in the laundry, the washrooms, and the mess hall. I guess with 3,000 kids spread out over a square mile, it was impossible to watch everyone all the time. Still, they watched enough to put the fear of God in us. You had a better-than-average chance of being busted if you practiced your abilities, even under the cover of darkness. Those blinking lights were the exact same shade as the blood-red band the PSFs wore around the upper part of their right arm. The symbol for the Greek letter Psi was stitched on the crimson fabric, indicating their unfortunate role as caretakers of the country's freak children. The camera above my bed had no red light. The relief that came over me at the realization actually made the air taste sweet. For just a moment, I was alone and unobserved. At Thurmond, that was an almost unheard-of luxury. Dr. Begbie, Kate, hadn't completely closed the curtain. When another doctor hurried past, the thin white fabric pulled back farther, allowing a familiar flash of blue to catch my eye. The portrait of a young boy, no more than 12 years old, stared back at me. His hair was the same shade as mine, deep brown, nearly black, but where my eyes were pale green, his were dark enough to burn from a distance. He was smiling, as always, his hands clasped in his lap, his dark school uniform without a wrinkle. Clancy Gray, Thurmond's first inmate. There were at least 2 framed pictures of him in the mess hall, 1 in the kitchen, several nailed outside of the green outhouses. It was easier to remember his face than it was to remember my mom's. I forced myself to look away from his proud, unwavering grin. He may have gotten out, but the rest of us were still here. As I tried to readjust my body, I knocked Dr. Begbie's clipboard off my lap and into the crook of my left arm. I knew there was a chance that they were watching, but I didn't care. Not then, when I had answers inches away from my fingertips. Why had she left it there, right below my nose, if she hadn't wanted me to see it? Why hadn't she taken it with her, like all of the other doctors would have done? What was different about the white noise? What did they figure out? The fluorescent lights above me were exposed, glowing in the shape of long, angry bones. They gave off a hum, sounding more and more like a cloud of flies swirling around my ears. It only got worse as I flipped the clipboard over. It wasn't my medical history. It wasn't my current injuries or lack thereof. It wasn't my answers to Dr. Begbie's questions. It was a note. And it read, "New CC was testing for undetected Ys, Os, Rs. Your bad reaction means that they know you aren't G. Unless you do exactly as I say, they will kill you tomorrow." My hands were shaking. I had to set the clipboard down in my lap to read the rest. "I can get you out. Take the 2 pills under this note before bed, but don't let the PSF see you. If you don't, we'll keep your secret, but I can't protect you while you're in here. Destroy this." It was signed, "A friend, if you'd like." I read the note 1 more time before I ripped it out from under the metal clip and shoved it in my mouth. It tasted like the bread they served us for lunch. The pills were in a tiny, clear bag clipped on top of my real medical chart. Scrawled in Dr. Begbie's dismal handwriting was the note. "Subject 3285 hit her head against the ground and lost consciousness. Nose was fractured when subject 3286 elbowed her. Possible concussion." My eyes were itching to look up, to peer into the black eye of the camera, but I didn't let myself. I took the pills and shoved them into the standard-issue sports bra the camp controllers had bestowed on us when they realized 1,500 teenage girls weren't going to stay 12 and flat forever. I didn't know what I was doing. I really didn't. My heart was racing so fast that for a moment I couldn't get any air. Why had Dr. Begbie done this to me? She knew I wasn't green, but she had covered it up, lied on the report. Was this just a trick? To see if I would incriminate myself? I pressed my face into my hands. The packet of pills burned against my skin. They will kill you tomorrow. Why did they even bother to wait? Why not take me out to the buses and shoot me now? Isn't that what they did with the others? The yellows, oranges, and reds? They killed them because they were too dangerous. I am too dangerous. I didn't know how to use my abilities. I wasn't like the other oranges who could spout off commands or slip nasty little thoughts into other people's minds. I had all of the power and none of the control. All of the pain and none of the benefits. From what I'd been able to figure out, I had to touch someone for my abilities to take hold, and even then, it was more like I was glimpsing their thoughts rather than screwing with them. I'd never tried to push a thought into someone else's head, and it wasn't like I'd had the opportunity or desire to try. Every slip of the mind, intentional or not, left my head a jumble of thoughts and images, words and pain. It took hours to feel like myself again. Imagine someone reaching straight into your chest, past the bones and blood and guts, and taking a nice, firm hold on your spinal cord. And now imagine that they start shaking you so fast the world starts bulging and buckling under you. Imagine not being able to figure out later if the thought in your head is really yours or an unintentional keepsake from someone else's mind. Imagine the guilt of knowing you saw someone's deepest, darkest fear or secret. Imagine having to face them the next morning and pretend you didn't see how their father used to hit them, the bright pink dress they wore to their fifth birthday party, their fantasies about this boy or that girl, and the neighborhood animals they used to kill for fun. And then imagine the soul-crushing migraine that always follows, lasting anywhere between a few hours and a few days. That was what it was like. That was why I tried to avoid my mind so much as brushing up against someone else's at all costs. I knew the consequences. All of them. And now I knew for certain what would happen if they found me out. I flipped the clipboard over on my lap, and just in time. The same PSF soldier was back at my curtain again, ripping it aside. "You'll be returning to your cabin now," he said. "Come with me."
My cabin?
I searched his face for any sign of a lie, but saw nothing except the usual annoyance. A nod was the only thing I could muster. My entire body was one earthquake of dread, and the moment my feet touched the ground, the back of my head uncorked. Everything spilled out, every thought, fear, and image. I collapsed against the guardrail, holding on tight to consciousness. The black spots were still gliding in front of my eyes when the PSF barked out, "Hurry it up! Don't think you get to stay another night here just by putting on an act." Despite the harsh words, I saw the slightest flicker of fear in his face. That moment, the shift from fear to fury could have summed up the feelings of every soldier at Thurmond. We'd heard rumors that service in the military was no longer voluntary, that everyone between the ages of 22 and 40 had to serve, most of them in the Army's new Psi branch. I gritted my teeth. The whole wide world spun under me, trying to pull me back down to its dark center. The PSF's words returned to me. "Another night?" I thought. "How long have I been here?" Still woozy, I followed the soldier into the hallway. The infirmary was only two stories, small ones. The ceiling crept down so low that even I felt like I was in danger of scraping the top of my head on the door frames. The treatment beds were on the first floor, but the second was reserved for kids needing to go into what we called time out. Sometimes they had something the rest of us could catch, but mostly it was for kids that went completely off their rocker, broken brains broken further by Thurmond. I tried to stay focused on the movement of the PSF's shoulder blades beneath his black uniform, but it was difficult when most of the curtains had been left open for anyone to peer inside. Most I could ignore or cast only a brief glance their way, but the second-to-last stall before the exit doors? My feet slowed of their own accord, giving my lungs time to breathe in the scent of rosemary. I could hear Dr. Begbie's gentle voice as she spoke to another kid in green. I recognized him. His cabin was directly across from mine. Matthew, maybe Max. All I knew was that there was blood on his face, too, crusted around his nose and eyes, smearing across his cheeks. A stone dropped in my stomach. Had this green been marked, too? Was Dr. Begbie cutting him the same deal? I couldn't have been the only one to figure out how to dodge the sorting system, who to influence, when to lie. Maybe he and I were the same color beneath our skin, and maybe we would both be dead by tomorrow. Keep up, the PSF snapped. He didn't try to hide his annoyance as I hobbled after him, but he didn't need to worry. You couldn't have paid me to stay in the infirmary, not while I was conscious, not even with the new threat hanging over my head. I knew what they used to do there. I knew what was under the layers of white paint. The earliest kids they had brought in, the first guinea pigs, had been subjected to a whole array of electroshock and brain chop shop terrors. Stories were passed around camp with sick, almost holy reverence. The scientists were looking for ways to strip the kids' abilities, rehabilitate them. But they had mostly just stripped their will to live. The ones who made it out were given warden positions when the first small wave of kids was brought to camp. It was a strange bit of luck and timing that I had come in during the second wave. Each wave grew larger and larger as the camp expanded, until, 3 years ago, they'd run out of space completely. There were no new buses after that. I still wasn't moving fast enough for the soldier. He pushed me forward into the hall of mirrors. The exit sign cast its gory light over us. The PSF shoved me again, harder, and smiled when I fell. Anger flooded through me, cutting through the lingering pain in my limbs and any fear I had that he was taking me out somewhere in order to finish the job. Soon we were standing outside, breathing in the damp spring air. I took a lungful of misty rain and swallowed the bitterness down. I needed to think. Assess. If he was taking me outside to be shot and was on his own, I could easily overpower him. That wasn't the issue. But in fact, I had no way of slipping past the electric fence, and no idea where the hell I was. When they had brought me to Thurmond, the familiarity of the scenery had been more a comfort than a painful reminder. West Virginia and Virginia aren't all that different, even though Virginians would have you believe otherwise. Same trees, same sky, same awful weather. I was either drenched in rain or sticky with humidity. Anyway, it might not have been West Virginia at all, but a girl in my cabin swore up and down that she had seen a Welcome to West Virginia sign on her ride in, so that was the theory we were working with. The PSF had slowed considerably, matching my pathetic pace. He fumbled once or twice against the muddy grass, nearly tripping over himself in full view of the soldiers high above on the control tower. The moment the tower came into view, a whole new weight added itself to the ball and chain of terror I was dragging behind me. The building itself wasn't that imposing. It was only called the tower because it stuck up like a broken finger in a sea of one-story wooden shacks arranged in rings. The electric fence was the outer ring, protecting the world from us freaks. Cabins of greens made up the next two rings, blues the next two rings. Before they were taken away, the few reds and oranges lived in the next rings. They'd been closest to the tower. Better, the controllers thought, to keep an eye on them. But after a red had blown up his cabin, they moved the reds farther away, using the greens as a buffer in case any of the real threats tried to make a run for the fence. Number of escape attempts? 5. Number of successful escape attempts? 0. I don't know of one blue or green who had ever tried to make a run for it. When kids did stage desperate, pathetic breakouts, it had been in small groups of reds, oranges, and yellows. Once caught, they never came back. But that was in the early days, when we had had more interaction with the other colors, and before they shuffled us around. The empty red, orange, and yellow cabins became blue cabins, and newly arriving greens, the biggest group of all, filled the old blue ones. The camp grew so large that the controllers staggered our schedules, so we ate by color and gender, and even then it was still a tight squeeze fitting everyone at the tables. I hadn't seen a boy my own age up close in years, I didn't start breathing again until the tower was at our backs and it was clear, beyond a shadow of a doubt, where we were headed. Thank you, I thought, to no one in particular. The relief lodged in my throat like a stone. We reached cabin 27 a few minutes later. The PSF walked me to the door and pointed to the spigot just to the left of it. I nodded and used the cold water to wash the blood off my face. He waited silently, but not patiently. After a few seconds, I felt his hand grab the back of my shirt and yank me up. Using his other hand, he slid his access card through the lock on our door. Ashley, one of the older girls in my cabin, shoved the door open the rest of the way with her shoulder. She took my arm in one hand and nodded in the direction of the PSF. That seemed to be enough for him. Without another word, he took off down the path.
Jesus Christ! She hissed as she dragged me inside. They couldn't have kept you another night? Oh no, they have to send you back early? Is that blood?
I waved her hands away, but Ashley pushed past the others and brushed my long, dark hair over my shoulder. At first I didn't understand why she was looking at me like that, with wide eyes, rimmed with a raw pink. She sucked her bottom lip in between her teeth.
I really thought you were...
We were still standing by the door, but I could feel the chill that had taken over the cabin. It settled over my skin like cold silk. Ashley had been around these parts for far too long to really crack, but I was still surprised to see her so frazzled and at a loss for what to say. She and a few other girls were honorary leaders of our sad, mismatched group, nominated mostly because they hit certain bodily milestones before the rest of us and could explain what was happening to us without laughing in our faces. I offered a weak smile and a shrug, suddenly without words again. But she didn't look convinced, and she didn't let go of my arm. The cabin was dark and damp. The usual smell of mold clung to every surface. But I would have taken that over the infirmary's clean, sterile stench any day.
Let me... Ashley took a deep breath. Let me know if you're not. Got it?
And what would you be able to do about it? I wanted to ask. Instead, I turned to the back left corner of our cramped cabin. Whispers and stares followed my zigzagging path around the rows of bunk beds. The pills tucked tight against my chest felt like they were on fire.
She was gone,
I heard someone say. Vanessa, who slept on the bottom bunk to the right of mine, had snuck up to Sam's bed. When I came into view, they stopped mid-conversation to stare down at me. Eyes wide, mouths wider. The sight of them together was still sickening to me, even after a year. How many days and nights had I spent perched up there with Sam, steadfastly ignoring Vanessa's attempts to drag us into some stupid, pointless conversation? Sam's best friend slot had been vacant for less than 2 hours when Vanessa had slithered in, and not a day went by that Vanessa didn't remind me of that.
What?
Sam leaned over the edge of her bed. She didn't look haughty or hostile, the way she usually did. She looked concerned, curious.
What happened to you?
I shook my head, my chest tight with all the things I wanted to say. Vanessa let out a sharp laugh.
Nice, real nice. And you wonder why she doesn't want to be your friend anymore?
I don't... Sam mumbled.
Whatever.
Sometimes I wondered if there was a part of Sam that remembered not just me, but the person she used to be before I ruined her. Amazing how I had managed to erase every good part of Sam, or at least all the parts I loved. One touch, and she was gone. A few girls asked me what had happened between the two of us. Most, I think, assumed Sam was being cruel when she claimed that we had never, ever been friends and never would be. I tried to play it off with shrugs, but Sam was the only thing that had made Thurmond bearable. Without her, it was no life at all. No life at all. I fingered the packet of pills. Our cabin was brown on brown on brown. The only color was the white of our sheets, and most of those had aged to an ugly yellow. There were no shelves of books, no posters, no pictures. Just us. I crawled onto my low bunk, dropping face first into the worn sheets. I breathed in their familiar scent, bleach, sweat, and something distinctly earthy, and tried not to listen to the conversation above me. Part of me had been waiting, I think, desperate to see if I could fix what I had done to my friend. But it was done. It was over and she was gone, and the only one to blame was me. The best thing I could do for her was disappear. Even if Dr. Begbie was playing me and they really were going to get rid of me, they wouldn't connect us. They wouldn't question or punish Sam because they thought she had helped me hide, like they would if we had still been friends. There were over 3,000 of us at Thurmond, and I was the last orange, maybe in the entire world, or one of two, if the boy in the infirmary was like me. It had only been a matter of time before they found out the truth. I was dangerous, and I knew what they did to the dangerous ones. The camp routine ran itself through, as it always did, churning us through the mess hall for dinner, to the washrooms, and back to the cabin for the night. The light was dim and fading outside, clinging to the first fringes of night. "All right, kittens," Ashley's voice. 10 minutes to lights out. Whose turn is it?"
"Mine. Should I just pick up from where we left off?"
Rachel was on the other side of the room, but her squeaky voice carried well. I could practically hear Ashley's eyes rolling. "Yes, Rachel, isn't that what we always do?"
"Okay, so the princess, she was in her tower, and she was still really sad."
"Girl," Ashley cut in, "you're going to have to spice this up or I'm skipping your boring ass and going to the next person."
"Okay,"
Rachel squeaked. I rolled over onto my side, trying to get a glimpse of her through the rows of bunk beds.
"The princess was in terrible pain. Terrible, terrible pain."
"Oh, God," was Ashley's only comment. "Next." Macy picked up the loose story threads the best she could.
"While the princess was locked away in her tower, all she could think about was the prince."
I missed how the story ended, my eyelids too heavy to keep them open. If there is a single thing I'll miss about Thurmond, I thought as I edged toward sleep, it's this. The quiet moments, when we were allowed to talk about forbidden things. We had to find a way to amuse ourselves because we had no stories, no dreams, no future, other than the ones we created for ourselves. I swallowed the two pills one at a time, the taste of chicken broth still on my tongue. The cabin lights had been off for 3 hours, and Sam had been snoring for two. I unsealed the bag and dropped the little pills into my hand. The clear bag went back into my bra, and the first pill went into my mouth. It was warm from being so close to my skin for so long, which didn't make it any easier to swallow. I popped the next one in before I lost the nerve, and winced as it clawed its way down my throat. And then, I waited. 5. I didn't remember falling asleep, only waking. Of course I did. My body was shaking so hard that I rolled right out of bed and hit my face against the next bunk over. Vanessa must have jumped out of her skin with the sudden bang and movement of her bed, because I heard her say, "What the hell, Ruby? Is that you?" I couldn't get up. I felt her hands on my face and registered she was now screaming my name, not just whispering it. "Oh my God," someone said. It sounded like Sam, but I couldn't open my eyes. "Emergency button." Ashley's weight settled over my legs. I knew it was her, even as my brain came in and out of consciousness, and a white-hot light was burning behind my eyelids. Someone shoved something in my mouth, rubber and hard. I could taste blood, but I wasn't sure if it had come from my tongue or my lips or... Two pairs of hands lifted me from the ground, dropping me on some other surface. I still couldn't open my eyes. My chest was on fire. I couldn't stop shaking, and my limbs felt like they were caving in on themselves. And then I smelled rosemary. I felt soft, cool hands pressing against my chest. Then, nothing at all. Life came back to me in the form of a hard slap across the face. "Ruby," someone said. Come on, I know you can hear me. You have to wake up. I cracked my eyes open, trying not to cringe as the light flooded in. A door opened and creaked shut somewhere nearby. Is that her? A new voice asked. Are you going to sedate her? No, not this one, the first voice returned. I knew that voice. It was as sweet as it had been before, only this time it had a sharper edge. Dr. Begbie's hands came up beneath my arms and propped me up. She's tough. She can handle it. Something smelled horrible, acidic and rotten all at once. My eyes flew open. Dr. Begbie was kneeling beside me, waving something beneath my nose. What? The other voice I had heard belonged to a young woman. She had dark brown hair and pale skin, but that was all that was remarkable about her. Not realizing I was watching her, she stripped her blue scrubs off and threw them at Dr. Begbie. I didn't know where we were. The room was small, filled with shelves of bottles and boxes, and I couldn't smell anything besides whatever it was Dr. Begbie had used to wake me. Put these on, Dr. Begbie said, pulling me to my feet whether my legs were ready or not. Come on, Ruby, we've got to hurry. My body felt heavy, cracking at all my joints, but I did as I was told and pulled the scrubs over my uniform. While I was dressing, the other woman put her hands behind her back and waited as Dr. Begbie wrapped them together with thick silver duct tape. That finished, the doctor moved to tying the other woman's feet together. You're meeting them in Harvey. Make sure you take Route 215. I know, Dr. Begbie said as she chewed off another piece of tape and placed it over the woman's mouth. Good luck. What are you doing? I asked. My throat was scratchy, and the skin around my mouth seemed to crack as I spoke. The doctor pulled my hair back, twisting it up into a messy bun that she secured with a rubber band. The other woman watched as her ID tags were dropped over my neck, and Dr. Begbie put a surgical mask over my face. I'll explain everything once we're out, but we can't waste time. They'll be doing rounds in 20 minutes, she said. You can't say anything. Understand? Play along. I nodded and let her push me outside of the dark room and into the dimmed hallway of the infirmary. Once again, my legs seemed to be failing me, but the doctor took it all in stride. She looped one of my arms over her shoulder and supported most of my weight. We're moving, she muttered. Return the cameras to their normal feeds. I looked over, but she wasn't talking to me. She was whispering to her gold swan pin. Not a word, she reminded me as we turned down another long hallway. We were moving so fast that we rustled the white curtains of the examination stalls as we passed them. The PSFs were black blurs as they stepped out of our way. Sorry, Dr. Begbie called after us. I've got to get this one home. I kept my eyes on the straight lines of tile passing under my feet. My head was still spinning so badly that I didn't realize we were heading outside until I heard the beep of the doctor's card passing through the lock swipe and felt the first drops of cool rain hit my scalp. They kept the camp's enormous stadium lights on at all hours of the night. The lights stood like giants across the camp, but all they reminded me of were night football games, the smell of fresh-cut grass, and the back of my dad's red Spartan sweater as he yelled for his old high school's team to run some damn offense at the top of his lungs. It was a short walk and stumble from the back of the infirmary to the pebbled parking lot. I actually wasn't sure if I was hallucinating or not. My sight went in and out of focus, but it was impossible to miss the sound of crunching gravel and the voice that yelled, "Everything okay over there?" I felt, rather than saw, Dr. Begbie tense. I tried to keep moving, to use her shoulder to prop myself up, but my legs just weren't working anymore. When I opened my eyes again, I was sitting up, staring at the standard-issue boots of a PSF soldier. He knelt down in front of me. Dr. Begbie was saying something to him, her voice as calm as the first time I had spoken to her. So sick, I offered to drive her home. I put the mask on her to make sure she didn't give the bug to anyone else. The soldier's voice became clearer. I hate that we always get sick from these kids. Would you mind helping me walk her over to my Jeep? Dr. Begbie asked. If she's sick...
It'll just take a minute, the doctor interrupted, and I promise that if you have so much as even the sniffles tomorrow, I'll nurse you back to health myself. That was the voice I recognized, so sweet that it sounded like little bells. The soldier chuckled, but I felt him lift me up all the same. I tried not to lean against him, to grit my teeth against the jarring motion, but I could barely keep my head from rolling back. "Front seat?" he asked. Dr. Begbie was about to respond when the PSF's radio crackled to life. "Control has you on camera. Do you need assistance?" He waited until Dr. Begbie had opened the front passenger side door, and he set me down on the seat before replying.
"Everything clear. Dr....
He took my tags in hand, lifting them off my chest.
"Dr. Rogers has the virus that's been going around. Dr....
Begbie," came the quick reply. She slid into the driver's seat and slammed the door shut behind her. I glanced over, watching as she fumbled to get the key in the ignition. It was the first time I noticed her hands shaking.
"Dr. Begbie is driving her home for the night. Dr. Rogers's car will be here overnight. Please inform the morning guards when they do their tally. Roger that. Tell them to head straight for the gate. I'll notify the watch patrol to wave them through."
The Jeep sputtered to life in a series of grinding protests. I looked out through the windshield to the electric fence and the dark, familiar forest behind it. Dr. Begbie reached over to fasten my seatbelt.
"Man, she's out of it."
The PSF was back, leaning against Dr. Begbie's window. "I did give her some pretty strong stuff," Dr. Begbie laughed. I felt my chest clench.
"So, about tomorrow?"
"Come by and say hello, okay?" Dr. Begbie said. "I have a break around 3. She didn't give him a chance to reply. The tires spun against the gravel and the windshield wiper squealed to life. Dr. Begbie rolled up her window with a friendly wave, using her other hand to steer the car back and pull out of the parking space. The little green numbers on the dashboard read 2:45 a.m. "Try to cover your face as much as possible," she muttered before flicking on the radio. I didn't recognize the song, but I recognized David Gilmour's voice and the ebb and flow of Pink Floyd's synthesizers. She turned the volume down, taking a deep breath as she turned out of the lot. Her fingers tapped out a nervous rhythm on the steering wheel. "Come on, come on," she whispered, glancing down at the clock again. There was a line of 2 cars in front of us, each waved forward with agonizing slowness. I thought she was going to crawl out of her skin by the time the last car pulled forward into the night. Dr. Begbie hit the gas too hard, and the Jeep lurched forward. The seatbelt snapped into a locked position when she slammed on the brakes, knocking the air out of my chest. She rolled the window down, but I was too tired to be afraid. I pressed my hand over my eyes and sucked in a deep breath. The surgical mask brushed against my lips. "I'm taking Dr. Rogers home. Let me just get her passes."
"It's fine. I have you on the schedule for tomorrow at 3 p.m., is that correct?"
"Yes, thank you. Please indicate Dr. Rogers will not be in."
"Understood?"
I was too tired to try to control my brain's wandering fingers. When Dr. Begbie touched me again, brushing the hair out of my face, an image bloomed to life behind my eyes. A dark-haired man, smiling broadly, with his arms around Dr. Begbie, spinning her and spinning her and spinning her until I could hear her delighted laughter in my ears. Kate cracked our windows, and the air rushing by brought in the scent of rain and carried me quickly into sleep. 6. It was still dark out when I opened my eyes. The AC blew through the vents, batting at the little yellow cardboard tree hanging down from the rearview mirror. Its vanilla fragrance was sickeningly sweet and so overwhelming that it turned my empty stomach. Mick Jagger crooned next to my ear, singing about war and peace and shelter, those kinds of lies. I tried to turn my face away from wherever the song was escaping from, but I only managed to smack my nose against the window and strain my neck. I sat straight up and almost hanged myself on the gray seatbelt. We weren't in the Jeep anymore. The night came back like a deep breath, complete and overwhelming all at once. The glow of the green dashboard lit the scrubs I wore, and that was enough to flood my mind with the reality of what had happened. Smears of trees and undergrowth lined a road that was completely dark, save for the small car's weak yellow headlights. For the first time in years, I could see the stars that Thurman's monstrous lights had faded into non-existence. They were so bright, so clear, that they couldn't have been real. I didn't know what was more shocking, the endless stretch of road or the sky. Tears pricked at the back of my eyes. "Don't forget to breathe, Ruby," came the voice beside me. I pulled the surgical mask down from over my mouth as I looked over. Dr. Begbie's blonde hair was around her face, sweeping against her shoulders. In the time it had taken us to get from Thurman to wherever we were, she had stripped off her scrubs and changed into a black T-shirt and jeans. The night stained the skin under her eyes like bruises. I hadn't noticed the sharp angles that made up her nose and chin. "You haven't been in a car for some time, huh?" she laughed. But she was right. I was more aware of the forward lurch of the car than I was of my own heartbeat. "Dr. Begbie? Call me Kate," she interrupted, a bit harsher than before. I don't know if I reacted to the abrupt change of tone or not, but she immediately followed with, "I'm sorry. It's been a very long night, and I could use a cup of coffee." According to the dashboard, it was 4:30 a.m. I had only had 2 hours of sleep, but I felt more alert than I had all day, all week, all my life. Kate waited until the Rolling Stones had finished out their song before turning down the radio. "All they play are oldies now. I thought it was a joke at first, or something Washington wanted, but apparently that's all that gets requested these days." She snuck a look at me out of the corner of her eye. "I can't imagine why." "Doctor, Kate," I said. Even my voice was stronger. "Where are we? What's going on?" Before she could answer, there was a cough from the back seat. I twisted around despite the pain in my neck and chest. Curled up there in a protective little ball was another kid, about my age or maybe a year younger. That other kid. Max, Matthew, whatever, from the infirmary, and he was looking far better than I felt as he slept on. "We just left Harvey, West Virginia," Kate said. "That's where we met with some friends that helped me switch cars and remove Martin back there from the medical trunk we had to smuggle him out in."
"Wait.
Oh, don't worry," Kate said quickly. "We made sure it had air holes."
Like that was my biggest concern?
"They just let you take it out to the car?" I asked, "without even checking it?" She glanced at me again, and I was proud of the look of surprise there. "The doctors at Thurmond use those trunks to transport medical waste. The camp controllers started forcing the doctors to dump the waste themselves when the budget got cut. Sarah and I had duty for this week."
"Sarah," I interrupted.
"Dr. Rogers?" She hesitated a split second before nodding. "Why did you tie her up? Why did she... Why are you helping us?" She answered my question with one of her own. "Have you ever heard of the Children's League?"
"Bits and pieces," I said, and only in whispers. If the rumors were true, they were an anti-government group. They were the ones the younger kids, the later arrivals to Thurmond, claimed were trying to take down the camp system. The ones that supposedly hid kids so they couldn't be taken. I had always assumed they were our generation's version of a fairy tale. Nothing that good could ever be true.
"We?" Kate said, letting that word sink in before continuing, "are an organization dedicated to helping children affected by the government's new laws. John Albin. Have you heard of him? He was formerly an intelligence advisor to Gray."
"He started the Children's League?"
She nodded. "After his daughter died and he realized what was going to happen to the kids who survived, he left D.C. and tried to expose all of the testing that was happening at the camps.
The New York Times, The Post, you name it. None of them would run the story, because by then things were bad enough that Gray had them under his thumb for national security reasons, and the smaller papers folded along with the economy. So, I was trying to wrap my mind around this, wondering if I had misheard her. So he created the Children's League to help us? Kate's face lit up in a smile. Yes, that's exactly right. Then why did you help only me? The question sprung up like a lone weed, ugly and deeply rooted. I rubbed a hand over my face, trying to clear the rumblings in my brain, but I couldn't tear it out. There was a strange feeling rising in my chest that followed, like something heavy was trying to work its way up from my center. It might have been a scream. What about the others? I didn't recognize my own voice. The others? You mean the other children? Kate's eyes were focused only on the road in front of us. They can wait. Their situation wasn't as pressing as yours was. When the time is right, I'm sure we'll go back for them. But in the meantime, don't worry. They'll live. I recoiled almost instantly at her tone more than her words. The way she said that, they'll live, was so dismissive. I half expected to see a hand come up into the air to wave me off. Don't worry. Don't worry at the way they've been mistreated. Don't worry about their punishments. Don't worry about the guns constantly trained on their backs. God, I wanted to throw up. I had left them behind. All of them. I had left Sam even after I promised we'd get out together. After everything she had done to protect me, I had just left her there. Oh, no, Ruby. I'm sorry, I didn't even realize how that would sound, she said, turning back and forth between me and the road. I just meant, I don't even know what I'm saying. I was there for weeks, and I still can't begin to imagine what it must have been like. I shouldn't act like I know what you went through. I left them, I told her, and it didn't matter that my voice was breaking or that my hands had come up to clutch my elbows to keep from grabbing her. Why did you only take me? Why couldn't you save the others? Why? I told you before, she said softly. It had to be you. They would have killed you otherwise. The others aren't in danger. They're always in danger, I said, and wondered if she had stepped a single foot beyond the infirmary. How could she not have seen? How could she not have heard it, felt it, breathed it in? The air at Thurmond was so coated in fear that you could taste it like vomit at the back of your throat. It had taken me less than a day in that place to see that hatred and terror came in circles, and that they fed off each other. The PSFs hated us, so they had to make us fear them. And we feared them, which only made us hate them even more. There was an unspoken understanding that we were at Thurmond because of each other. Without the PSFs, there would be no camp. But without the Psy Freaks, there would be no need for PSFs. So, whose fault was it? Everyone's? No one's? Ours? You should have just left me. You should have taken someone else, someone who is better. They'll be punished because of this, I know it. They'll hurt them, and it's my fault for going, for leaving them behind. I knew I wasn't making sense, but I couldn't seem to connect my thoughts to my tongue. That feeling, the heart-swallowing guilt, the sadness that took hold and never let itself be shaken free. How did you tell someone that? How did you put that into words? Kate's lips parted, but no sound came out for several moments. She took a firm hold of the wheel and guided the car over to the side of the road. Her foot came off the gas, and she allowed the car to roll to a hesitant stop. When the wheels finally ceased spinning, I reached for the door handle, a spike of total and complete grief cutting through me. "What are you doing?" Kate asked. She had pulled over because she wanted me to get out, hadn't she? I would have done the same thing if our situations had been flipped. I understood. I leaned back away from her arm as she reached over, but instead of pushing the door open, she slammed it shut and let her fingers linger over my shoulder. I cringed, pressing back against the seat as hard as I could, trying to avoid her touch. This was the worst I'd felt in years. My head was humming, a sure sign I was dangerously close to losing control of it. If she had any thoughts about hugging me or stroking my arm or anything my mom would have done, my reaction was more than enough to convince her not to try.
"Listen to me very carefully," she said, and it didn't seem to matter to her that at any moment a car or a PSF could come charging up the road. She waited until I was looking her in the eye.
"The most important thing you ever did was learn how to survive. Do not let anyone make you feel like you shouldn't have, like you deserved to be in that camp. You are important and you matter. You matter to me, you matter to the League, and you matter to the future." Her voice caught. "I will never hurt you or yell at you or let you go hungry. I will protect you for the rest of my life. I will never fully understand what you've been through, but I will always listen when you need to get something out. Do you understand?" Something warm bloomed in my chest, even as my breath hitched in my throat. I wanted to say something to that, to thank her, to ask her to repeat it again just to be sure I hadn't misunderstood or misheard her. "I can't pretend like it never happened," I told her. I still felt the vibrations of the fence under my skin. "You shouldn't. You should never forget. But part of surviving is being able to move on. There's this word," she continued, turning to study her fingers gripping the wheel. "Nothing like it exists in the English language. It's Portuguese.
Saudade.
Do you know that one?"
I shook my head. I didn't know half the words in my own language.
"It's more... there's no perfect definition. It's more of an expression of feeling, of terrible sadness. It's the feeling you get when you realize something you once lost is lost forever, and you can never get it back again." Kate took a deep breath. "I thought of that word often at Thurmond, because the lives you had before, that we all had before, we can never get them back. But there's a beginning and an end, you know? It's true that you can't reclaim what you had, but you can lock it up behind you. Start fresh." I did understand what she was saying, and I understood that her words were coming from a true, caring place. But after having my life broken down into rotations for so long, the thought of dividing it up even further was unimaginable. "Here," she said, reaching inside the collar of her shirt. She pulled a long silver chain up over her head, and the last thing to reveal itself was the black circular pendant, a little bigger than the size of my thumb, hanging from it. I held out my hand, and she dropped the necklace into it. The chain was still warm from where it had been kept against her skin, but I was surprised to find that the pendant wasn't anything more than plastic. "We call that a panic button," she said. "If you squeeze it for 20 seconds, it activates, and any agents nearby will respond. I don't imagine you'll ever need to use it, but I'd like you to keep it. If you ever feel scared, or if we get separated, I want you to press it."
"It'll track me?"
Something about that idea made me vaguely uncomfortable, but I slipped the chain on anyway. "Not unless you activate it," Kate promised. "We designed them that way so that the PSFs wouldn't be able to accidentally pick up on a signal being transmitted from them. I promise, you're in control here, Ruby." I plucked the pendant up and held it between my thumb and my index finger. When I realized how dirty my fingers were and how much dirt was still packed under my nails, I dropped it. Me and nice things didn't go well together.
"Can I ask you another question?"
I waited until she had finally nudged the car back onto the road, and even then it had taken me a few tries to get the words out. "If the Children's League was formed to end the camps, why did you even bother getting me and Martin? Why didn't you just blow up the control tower while you were there?" Kate ran a hand over her lips. "I'm not interested in those kinds of operations," she said. "I'd much rather be focused on the real issue, which is helping you kids. You can destroy a factory, and they'll just build another. But once you destroy a life, that's it. You never get that person back.
Do people have any idea? I squeezed out. Do the people know that they're not reforming us at all?
I'm not sure, Kate said. Some will always live in denial about the camps, and they'll believe what they want to believe about them. I think most people know there's something off, but they're in too deep with their own problems to call into question how the government is handling things at the camps. I think they want to trust that you're all being treated well. Honestly, there are so few of you left now.
I sat straight up again.
What?
This time Kate couldn't look at me.
I didn't want to have to be the one to tell you this, but things are much worse now than they were before. The last estimate the League put together said that 2% of the country's population of 10 to 17-year-olds were in reform camps.
What about the rest? I said, but I already knew the answer. The 98%.
Most of them fell victim to IAAN.
They died, I corrected.
All the kids? Everywhere? No, not everywhere. There have been a few cases of it reported in other countries. But here in America, Kate took a deep breath. I don't know how much to tell you now, because I don't want to overwhelm you. But it seems like the onset of IAAN, or Psi powers, is linked to puberty.
How many?
They really hadn't learned anything new in all the years I was trapped in Thurmond.
How many of us are left?
According to the government, there are approximately 250,000 children under the age of 18, but our estimate is closer to a tenth of that.
I was going to be sick. I unbuckled my seatbelt and leaned forward, putting my head between my legs. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Kate's hand come down as if she was going to rest it on my back, but I twisted away again. For a long time, the only sound between us was the tires turning against the old road. I kept my face down and eyes shut long enough for Kate to worry.
Are you still feeling queasy? We had to give you a high enough dosage of penicillin to induce seizure-like symptoms. Trust me, if we could have done it any other way, we would have. But we needed something serious enough for the PSFs to actually bring you back to the infirmary.
Martin snored behind us until eventually even that faded into the sound of the tires rolling down the old road. My stomach twisted at the thought of asking exactly how many miles we were from Thurmond, how far away the past really was.
I know, I said after a while. Thank you. I mean it.
Kate reached over, and before I could think to stop her, her hand ran a smooth path from my shoulder down my arm. I felt something warm tickle at the back of my mind and recognized its warning trill. The first white-hot flash from her mind came and went so fast. I saw the scene like a photo negative. A young girl with white blonde hair in a high chair, her mouth frozen in a toothless grin. The next image stayed, lingered long enough for me to recognize I was seeing fire. Fire! Everywhere, climbing the walls of the room, burning with all the intensity of the sun. This memory? It trembled, shuddered hard enough that I had to clench my teeth to keep from getting nauseated. Inside Kate's memory, a silver door with 456B stamped over it in black lettering slid into view. A hand flashed out, reaching for the handle. Kate's pale, slender fingers outstretched, only to pull away at its molten hot touch. A hand lashed out against the wood, then a foot. The image wavered, curling at the edges as the door disappeared behind the dark smoke that spewed through its cracks and joints. The same dark door shut, and I jolted back, pulling my arm out from under hers.
What the hell? I thought, my heart racing in my ears. I squeezed my eyes shut.
Still? Kate said.
Oh, Ruby, I'm so sorry. When we switch cars, I'll be sure to ask for something to help ease your stomach.
She, like all the others, was oblivious.
You know, Kate said after a while.
She kept her eyes on the dark road to where it met the brightening sky.
It was brave of you to take the pills and come with me. I knew there was more to you than the quiet girl I met in the infirmary. I am not brave. If I had been, I would have owned up to what I really was, no matter how terrible. I would have worked, eaten, and slept alongside the other oranges, or at least stepped out of the shadow of the yellows and reds. Those kids had been so proud of their powers. They made a point of harassing the camp controllers at every turn, hurting the PSFs, setting their cabins and the washrooms on fire, trying to talk their way out of the gate, or driving the adults insane by putting images of murdered families or cheating wives in their heads. It was impossible to miss them, to not step aside and turn away when they passed. I had let myself sit like a coward in the dull, endless stream of gray and green, never drawing attention, never once letting myself believe that I could or should escape. I think that all they wanted was to find a way out, and to do it themselves. They had burned so bright and fought so hard to get free. But none of them had made it to 16. There are 1,000 ways to tell if someone is lying to you. You don't need to be able to glimpse into their mind to catch all of the little signs of insecurity and discomfort. More often than not, all you have to do is look at them. If they glance to the left while they're talking to you, if they add too many details to a story, if they answer a question with another question. My dad, a cop, taught me and 24 other kids about it in second grade when he gave his presentation on stranger danger. But Kate had no tells. She told me things about the world that didn't seem possible, not until we were able to pick up a radio station and a solemn voice bled through the speakers to confirm it all. "Yes!" she cried, slapping her palm against the wheel. "Finally!" The president has reportedly refused an invitation from Britain's prime minister to discuss possible relief measures for the world economic crisis and how to pump life back into the sagging global stock markets. When asked to explain his decision, the president cited the United Kingdom's role in the UN's economic sanctions against the United States. Kate fiddled with the tuning again. The newscaster's voice faded in and out. At the first burst of static, I jumped. 45 women were arrested in Austin, Texas yesterday for attempting to evade the birth registry. The women will be detained in a corrections facility until their children are born, after which the infants will be removed for the safety of their mothers and the state of Texas. The attorney general had this to say. Another voice came through, this one deep and raspy.
In accordance with New Order 15, President Gray issued an arrest warrant for all persons involved with this dangerous activity.
Gray? I said, glancing over to Kate. He's still the president? He had only just been elected when the first cases of IAAN appeared, and I couldn't really remember anything about him other than that he had dark eyes and dark hair. And even that I only knew because the camp controllers had strung up pictures of his son Clancy all over the camp as proof to us that we, too, could be reformed. I had a sudden, sharp memory of the last time I had been in the infirmary, and the way his picture had seemed to watch me. She shook her head, visibly disgusted. He granted himself a term extension until the Psy situation is, and I quote, resolved so as to make sure the United States is safe from telekinetic acts of terror and violence. He even suspended Congress.
How did he manage that? I asked.
With his so-called wartime powers, Kate said. Maybe a year or two after you were taken, some Psy kids nearly succeeded in blowing up the Capitol.
Nearly? What does that mean?